Planet FM is a platform that champions diversity. Not all our programs reflect the views of the station. We encourage you to consider a wide range of information from trusted sources when making decisions about your health.
So that importance of love, and the love that In the Ears are referring to, is really this kind of infinite healing love of that God force. And that, to me, was worth everything for this journey, that exposure. And of course, that very same love force is what near-death experiencers have brought back for thousands of years and increasing numbers in recent years. And it's what gives him that comfort to know there's nothing to fear about death. You know, in our materialist scientific society, we think, well, the brain and body are all there is, that is what we are. And then, of course, we have our thoughts and our consciousness, but we falsely believe that our thoughts and consciousness result from the chemical reactions and electron fluxes in that brain. And that is absolutely false. Our most recent book, Living in a Mindful Universe, goes into great detail about the unification of science and spirit that's happening now. And in fact, the science of consciousness is widely opening the door to the reality of the fundamental nature of consciousness, that in essence, our souls are eternal. And this is all something we can talk about a little bit later as we get into that third book, but it's absolutely something that's coming out of the scientific investigation of these. And my journey showed me very clearly that kind of robust fundamental role of consciousness independent of the brain, because that's exactly what I witnessed. And of course, I didn't know any of this to put it together until months after my coma, when I had the medical details to realize how ill my brain was. But there's no question, from the viewpoint of the tenets of modern neuroscience, my neocortex was not able to produce anything of the profound, phenomenal experience that I had in this journey.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. Dr. Eben mentions NDE, near-death experience. On the phone from Virginia in the United States, I have Dr. Eben Alexander. He is the author of the New York Times bestseller Proof of Heaven and Map of Heaven, and he has a third book co-authored with Karen Newell called Living in a Mindful Universe. And he's here to share with all of us around the curve here in the Southern Hemisphere. And I want to say kia ora and thank you, Eben.
Well, Tim, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, boy, the pleasure is all ours here. And I'm wanting to be able to let people know that you have had a very profound experience. It's been 12 years since your out-of-body or beyond-body experience, and in this one short hour, I realize you need to tell your stories. So, please, could you let listeners know of your experience beyond your body?
It would be my pleasure, and I'll tell you, I cannot tell you how beneficial all this has been to my life over the last 12 years, and also towards the end of this, we'll start getting into how this is all about a scientific revolution going on worldwide about the nature of consciousness. But I want to just start with my simple little part of that story, and that has to do with the fact that I grew up in a neurosurgical household. My dad was very influential in my life. He actually was a combat surgeon in the Second World War and spent a lot of time in the Pacific Theater, beginning in New Guinea, then the Philippines, finally up into Japan, in Tokyo, where he was stationed for several months after the war. But he came back to this country to head up a neurosurgical training program. But the reason I bring him up in this context is he had grown up very religious. His own dad had been a general surgeon in eastern Tennessee who had taken him to a Presbyterian church every Sunday of his life. And I think my dad's religious belief really got him through his World War II experience relatively unscathed. And like many of my generation, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and I always knew science is the pathway to truth. I've never doubted that, and I promise you I'm more of a scientist now than I've ever been. But I also realized that the materialist science, you know, kind of the conventional materialist, reductive materialism of the scientific community and the way it's interfaced with our world at large, is a disproven field of science, actually. The kind of Newtonian determinism of conventional scientific thinking has been displaced by quantum physics, and it completely opens the door to a tremendous new role for science to play in understanding our world, but it's one that absolutely demands elevating consciousness to a much higher level, because consciousness is not just the little epiphenomenon result of chemical reactions and electron fluxes in the brain, which is what I was led to believe in my scientific training. But in fact, in many ways, mind is primary. And we'll get into all that as we move along further into this conversation. But I want to start with kind of where I was. So in November of 2008, I was 54 years old. I was kind of top of my game in terms of being a neurosurgeon. I had spent 15 years teaching at Harvard Medical School, and by 2008, I had moved to Virginia and gone into a private practice job, and then was also involved in some other work with a very advanced technology called focused ultrasound surgery. But that's kind of a side story, because on the morning of November 10th, 2008, about 4:30, I woke up with severe back pain, soon realized I had a horrific headache, and within about 2.5 hours of symptom onset, I was starting to lapse into coma and then develop grand mal seizures, and I was gone from this world for the next 7 days. It turns out that my family originally thought that I was just going to sleep when I'd had all these medical complaints. They thought I was resting. But then when they saw the seizures, they realized something was very bad. And that's when they called the EMTs who came to the house, hustled me off to the Lynchburg General Hospital emergency room, seizing, basically unbreakable epileptic fits. They were finally able to stop those at the hospital, but I was deep in coma at that point, and I was gone, as I said, for the next 7 days. They put me on 3 powerful intravenous antibiotics, put me on a ventilator up on the medical ICU, and then the second day they got a real shocker back from microbiology when they found out it was E. coli meningoencephalitis. Now, E. coli, spontaneous meningitis, almost always happens in newborns. It's very rare to occur in anybody over 3 months of age. So my doctors had that big mystery facing them. What was I doing as a 54-year-old white male coming in with this diagnosis that almost always happened in newborns? And that was just the beginning of the mystery. But during that week, I really didn't show any signs of positive effects of these antibiotics. And in fact, by day 7 of my coma, the doctors were recommending stopping the antibiotics. And the reason for this, and the good news about all of this, is this medical case report on my medical records. Since I wrote Proof of Heaven, that case report has come out now. It came out in September of 2018. It was reported in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Diseases. And anyone can gain access to that report. If you go to evanalexander.com, look on my blog postings, and then go back to September 2018, and you'll find I wrote a blog about that medical case report, and that spells out the details that are there for the layperson to understand, because it's really a shocking report that does not leave, if you've got a medical education, it's shocking that that medical record led to somebody having a complete recovery. It really looks like the record of somebody who's going on to die. And in fact, the doctors who wrote that case report, who were not involved in my medical care, but were absolutely astonished by the degree of my recovery, which truly is shocking for anybody trained in medicine. The fact that I can put words together in a sentence now is really surprising, given the extent of my illness. A weakened coma, severe gram-negative bacterial meningoencephalitis, all 8 lobes of my brain involved, as according to MRI and CT scans, my neurologic exams showing my Glasgow coma scale, which in you or me right now would be 15, in a corpse would be 3, anything below 9 is deep coma, and as that medical report states, the vast majority of my coma, I was somewhere between probably 6 and 7. In fact, there are some places in the medical record where I was probably down to a 5. So really, just extremely deep coma with all 8 lobes of the brain involved. That kind of brain cannot support a dream, a confabulation, a hallucination, or drug effect, or any kind of conscious experience other than the most rudimentary experience, which is where I thought my initial experience would come in. I'm going to explain that in just a minute. But the point here is, this is why my case is of so much importance to the medical and scientific communities, is really because that recovery is so shocking and inexplicable. In fact, when the peer reviewers asked the three doctors who wrote the case report, how do they explain this miraculous recovery, their answer, I believe, is why they got it published. They said it's because of the near-death experience that he had such a miraculous recovery. And that really kind of gets down to the importance of all this for all of us. We've honored placebo effect for more than 60 years, which shows it's the gold standard for addressing any new kind of, assessing any new treatment or modality or medicine. And placebo effect is nothing more than the admission by the medical profession that beliefs, thoughts, and attitudes can have a tremendous role in our healing. And you bet that's true with a severe case of a near-death experience and the spiritual power of it. And that's really what's coming out of all this. And I think that's really the value, because so much of our world has come to believe in this kind of cold, mechanistic, reductive, materialistic kind of answer to all of our questions. And what we're finding is that just really doesn't work. That if you want to understand reality, we need to understand consciousness much better. And that's why my kind of case, which resembles, you know, tens of thousands of other near-death experiences that are out there reported on the internet and in the literature, is a lesson for all of us about the nature of our ultimate kind of being. So let me take you into the NDE itself. Important to point out that one of the atypical features of my near-death experience is that I was amnesic. I had absolutely no memories, no words, no language, no knowledge of Evan Alexander's life, knowledge of this earth, of this universe, for the entire near-death experience. Zero. Everything was gone. All memories. And to me, when I came back to this world in the early weeks trying to make sense of it, and it took 2 months for all of my neurosurgical knowledge and everything to come back. So in those early weeks, I really had no kind of neuroscientific knowledge and not much in the way of personal memories. But the thing that shocked me, of course, was the more I found out about this in the weeks after my coma, went in to see my doctors, went through my medical records, scans, and all that, and tried to explain it all, the more mysterious the whole thing appeared. And that's especially because of the experience that I'm now going to describe to you. It started in what I call the earthworm's eye view, a very primitive, coarse, unresponsive realm. And it's like being in dirty jello, and I have a strong memory of kind of the tactile sensation of roots or blood vessels around me. But important to point out, never in my near-death experience did I have any notion of a body awareness. I was always simply a speck of awareness, but never had a body or a physical body or a body of any sort to reference for any of this. Now, in that earthworm eye view, as I said, it was very kind of murky and sounds foreboding to talk about it. And I know initially when I gave talks about my experience, people would often say, was that earthworm eye view hell or purgatory? Well, I would think hell would be at least a little bit kind of interactive. And this earthworm eye view zone was nothing of the sort. It was just a very simple, coarse, kind of murky existence. And the good news is it didn't last forever. There came a slowly spinning white light that came packaged with a perfect musical melody. And that white light served as a portal up into this rich, ultra-real gateway valley, as I called it in my writings, and it's reported in the book Proof of Heaven. And that gateway valley, in many ways, was what so many people can think of as kind of the heavenly realm. It had a lot of earth-like features, but it also had some profound spiritual features that I'll discuss. But the earth-like features, I was a speck of awareness on a butterfly wing. There were millions of other butterflies, and they were all looping and spiraling in these vast formations. And it was all happening above this fertile meadow, very lush with life. In fact, I have a very strong memory of kind of the buds and blossoms, flowers, all of these signs of life and of beauty that we normally think of were erupting and growing in these dynamic and vibrant kind of cycles. But there was no death or decay anywhere. It was kind of like Plato's world of ideals, but for the individual soul. And in that realm, that's the realm where I would say we reunite with our higher souls, go through life reviews, plan next incarnations, all those kind of things. But for me, what that involved, especially given my amnesia for the life of Evan Alexander, was this incredible sense of kind of a spiritual home. It was very comforting, and it was absolutely beautiful beyond any description. There were these sparkling waterfalls and the crystal blue pools, and below the swarms of butterflies, of which I was a member, were thousands of beings down in the meadow that looked like peasants dressed in simple garb, although the clothing was very vibrant and alive, rich in color. But there was lots of joy and merriment and dancing and festivities. And I remember vividly children playing and dogs jumping. And all of this was being fueled because up above, in this blue-black velvety sky lit fully with these colors, these clouds of billowing color, were these swooping orbs of light. And when I came back to this world weeks later and finally had language back and was putting words to all this, I said that those swooping beings were angelic choirs, and they were emanating chants and anthems and hymns that would just thunder through me, just this amazing awakening. I remember early in the experience, there was this kind of sensation, again, in the midst of this kind of amnesia and this kind of first awareness of coming into this world in which I existed, this sense of a soft summer breeze that blew through and essentially changed everything. Even though the scene stayed the same, that breeze, which I came to refer to in my later writings as a divine wind or the breath of God, was this awareness of the infinitely loving force that was there as part of my conscious awareness, this God force of pure love. It was stunning. Initially, just kind of becoming aware that it kind of governed and was the kind of joy and energizer of this realm. But then, of course, as time went on, I came to realize that it was the ruler and kind of master in many ways, although it's very misleading to say that, because that God force, what I was experiencing there is the same force of love and comfort that near-death experiencers have described for thousands of years, going back at least to the time of Plato, who wrote about Armenian soldier Ur, who had been killed in battle. And when he came back to life after days dead on the battlefield, he said, the only important thing in your life is how much love you have managed to hand out to your fellow being. This from a soldier killed on the battlefield 2,400 years ago. So that importance of love, and the love that NDEers are referring to, is really this kind of infinite healing love of that God force. And that, to me, was worth everything for this journey, that exposure. And of course, that very same love force is what near-death experiencers have brought back for thousands of years and increasing numbers in recent years. And it's what gives him that comfort to know there's nothing to fear about death. You know, in our materialist scientific society, we think, well, the brain and body are all there is, that is what we are. And then, of course, we have our thoughts and our consciousness, but we falsely believe that our thoughts and consciousness result from the chemical reactions and electron fluxes in that brain. And that is absolutely false. Our most recent book, Living in a Mindful Universe, goes into great detail about the unification of science and spirit that's happening now. And in fact, the science of consciousness is widely opening the door to the reality of the fundamental nature of consciousness, that in essence, our souls are eternal. And this is all something we can talk about a little bit later as we get into that third book, but it's absolutely something that's coming out of the scientific investigation of these. And my journey showed me very clearly that kind of robust fundamental role of consciousness independent of the brain, because that's exactly what I witnessed. And of course, I didn't know any of this to put it together until months after my coma, when I had the medical details to realize how ill my brain was. But there's no question, from the viewpoint of the tenets of modern neuroscience, my neocortex was not able to produce anything of the profound, phenomenal experience that I had in this journey. Now, getting back into that Gateway Valley, I wasn't alone on that butterfly wing. There was a beautiful young woman with sparkling blue eyes, high forehead, high cheekbones, broad smile. She was dressed in the same kind of simple but very colorful garb as all those people dancing in the valley down below. And she never had to say a word. She looked at me on the wing of this butterfly with this look of pure love. And I cannot put into words the comfort and the kind of joy and kind of relief that that brought me, because her message, which came to me telepathically, and I only put it to words much later when I came back to this world, because initially it was not tainted with something as banal as our earthly language. But the words I would use to describe that message as it came to me in my mind, in my awareness on that butterfly wing, in the midst of this incredible scenery of this valley and all of this sensation of love that was kind of part of the environment, her message to me was very simple. And I think the most important message that I was to bring back as a messenger from this journey. You are deeply loved and cherished forever. You have nothing to fear. You are taken care of. And that is the essence of the message. The other part of it that I reported in Proof of Heaven, and I wish I'd elaborated on a little more where I placed it in the book, the other part of that message was you can do no wrong. And people really misinterpret that tremendously because they don't realize how much I already knew about that realm, about the power of love and kind of how love guided everything that we were to do and choose in that realm and this realm. So that statement of you can do no wrong, to me, at that time, essentially meant I understood the rules are here for us to live and learn these deep and profound lessons of kindness, compassion, unconditional love, mercy, acceptance, and forgiveness when necessary, forgiveness of self and others, these deep and profound principles that are to govern our choices. That's what she really meant by you can do no wrong. And yet people misinterpret that and think we can do anything we want in this world, and that is absolutely not the message of Proof of Heaven. So in that Gateway Valley, with that beautiful message from that guardian angel, and with all these beautiful festivities and everything going on below me, what happened next was even more astonishing, and that is that just as essentially that pathway up from the earthworm eye view to the Gateway Valley had started with a slowly spinning white light that turned into a portal, a light portal that allowed me to go from the earthworm eye view up into this rich, ultra-real Gateway Valley that was far more real, vibrant, and alive than anything I've ever experienced in this life. Well, those angelic choirs that had been providing tremendous anthems and chants that were thundering through me and kind of energizing all that joy and festivity in the Gateway Valley, they energized yet another portal. And that's when I saw that all of four-dimensional space-time in the kind of lower material realm that we live in here was collapsing down. And then also the overlying spiritual realms of that Gateway Valley and a completely different ordering of time. It's very important for people to understand that time flow in this earthly realm in many ways is part of the stage setting to allow the drama to unfold. But there's a much deeper ordering of time and causality from those spiritual realms that has to do with allowing our soul growth and a lot of the things that can happen in that realm. For example, the life review that I mentioned a little while ago, the life review is something commonly encountered by people in a near-death experience. 25 to 50% of people have a life review. And that's where you go back through the main events of your life that still harbor residual lessons to be taught and learned. And in a life review, the interesting thing when you talk to near-death experiencers is they don't describe experiencing that life review from their own viewpoint so much as from the perspective of those around them who were affected by their actions and even their thoughts. Yes. So the interesting thing about a life review is it shows you that our notions of here and now in many ways are part of a fiction. And that from that perspective, in that spiritual realm, we have access to all the events of our lives and, in fact, can relive them much more kind of realistically than when we went through them the first time here. And we experienced them from the perspective of others that were influenced by our actions. So if we were busy handing out pain and suffering to people, in our life review, we'll be on the business end of that. And we receive all of that. Likewise for the good stuff that we do for others. But this is important for pointing out to people how in many ways the life review is kind of a mid-course correction to help us realize the benefits of that love and kindness and compassion approach to both ourselves and others. So that life review is a very important concept. Now, I did not have an Eben Alexander life review because I had no memories of Eben Alexander's life. But what I did witness was between this realm, the Gateway Valley that I'm talking about, and the next realm, where those angelic choirs provided a light portal to higher and higher levels, where I reached what I call the core. The core was infinite inky blackness, but filled to overflowing with the divine love of that creative source. And there was a brilliant orb of light that I felt was there as some kind of a translator or a interpreter to help me kind of integrate and interface with that level of the universe. And, of course, this core realm is far beyond anything that we would normally try and describe with our earthly language as human beings. And it's one of the reasons why I say that my words as much as they do as good a job as I could hope to convey all this, that core realm is really beyond any reasonable description to fellow human beings. I mean, the entire higher dimensional multiverse was there, shrunken down as this complex overseer as part of the lessons I was to learn. And it turns out in that core realm, I was told, we'll teach you many things, but you'll be going back. And many of the lessons that I've unpacked in the 12 years since then that have to do with the nature of consciousness and this deeper understanding of reincarnation, you cannot understand any of this without understanding the scientific evidence and my journey showing me very clearly that our souls come back again and again in a process of refinement towards oneness with the divine.
Yes.
And that's an important part of it, was seeing that reincarnation and seeing these life reviews. To me, since I didn't have an Eben Alexander life review, the way I witnessed them, one was this fantastic vision of schools of flying fish. And in that kind of metaphorical presentation to me, we were the flying fish down in the material world, down in the water. And then between lives, we would hop back up out of the water, reunite with our higher souls and with souls of departed loved ones, go through those life reviews, then plan the issues of the next incarnation, and then dive back in. And there was another presentation that happened on another passage through the core that I likened to the notion out of Eastern spiritual traditions of Indra's net. And that is because the vision for me that showed me reincarnation and life reviews and kind of soul paths was one of this fantastic tapestry. In many ways, it was kind of like a spider web with a center, but the center was all aglow as kind of the ultimate kind of Christ consciousness omega point, as Teilhard de Chardin discussed in his book, The Phenomenon of Man in the Mid-20th Century. But to try and bring this to a close, to get to your questions, I'll point out that I cycled back through all these levels multiple times. I would go from that core realm, without explanation to me, back into the kind of lowly earthworm eye view. And what I learned is by remembering the musical notes of the melody, that would conjure up that portal, that light that would again usher me up into the Gateway Valley, always welcomed there by that beautiful girl on the butterfly wing and her reassuring messages. Seeing all the souls dancing below, all the joy and merriment, learning the lessons that I could learn in that environment, and then again, the angelic choirs above providing yet another portal to that highest level, to that core realm. And I went through that several times until finally, as I had been promised in the core, you're not here to stay, I realized one time in passing through that lowest realm that I could no longer conjure up the portal that led up into the Gateway Valley. To say I was sad at that point would be kind of a dramatic understatement, but I also realized by that point that I could trust in the universe, that I would be taken care of. So I had no fear of this situation, that I could no longer conjure up the light portal to lead me into the Gateway Valley. But I was now down in these kind of murky realms of the earth for my view, and seemingly with no apparent way back into those higher spiritual realms. And that's when I witnessed thousands of beings around me going off into the distance, kind of in these circles and arc, many with their head bowed, this tremendous murmuring energy coming from them. And when I came back to this world weeks later and was writing it all up, I said that was the power of prayer. That's what I realized that those people were doing, and by the thousands, their murmuring energy was giving me the same comfort, even in that lowly kind of earth where my view realm, as I'd had rising into the Gateway Valley and the core realms earlier. So I realized that even in these lowly realms near the material, that we can have that kind of joy and bliss and love that we can share with each other. And that was a beautiful lesson. And it was at that point that I saw six faces that would kind of bubble up out of the muck, and all this is discussed in Proof of Heaven. The reason those six faces were important is that five of them were people who were physically present, you know, close family members and friends, one of my physicians, who were there the last 24 hours I was in coma. And of note, the many family and friends who had been there earlier in the week were not apparent to me at all. That's why these six faces served as very powerful, what are known as veridical time anchors, to help me come to a deeper understanding, because they basically forced me to realize that the vast majority of the coma journey had to happen between days 1 and 5 of my coma. And I go into all that in detail in the book, why that is. It's also important in the case report, the doctors mentioned kind of the timing of my NDE with many of the events in my documented medical record. And they point out the importance of realizing how my Glasgow coma scale was basically 6 to 7 by their estimation, most of that time. In other words, very deep coma. And given the damage to my neocortex and all 8 lobes of the brain affected, that's why scientifically and from a medical standpoint, it makes such a strong case for the reality of this spiritual experience and also its importance in leading to my healing, in leading to my full recovery over 2 months. And it turns out that it was soon after all of that, those 6 phases, that I started coming back to this world. And back here on Earth, as told in the story Proof of Heaven, people realized that what was happening then, my youngest son, Bond, who was 10 years old at the time, they had protected him from most of the bad news during this week. But on that Sunday morning, day 7 of coma, he was outside the room and overheard the doctors talking about how it was time to just let me go, that I'd gone from a 10% chance of survival down to 2%. There was no chance for recovery given the devastating nature of this illness, and that it was time to stop the antibiotics. And that's what they did. And then a few hours later, I started coming back to this world. But the tragedy was, to my family, the guy who woke up in that bed in that ICU room didn't look much at all like the beloved husband, father, brother that they'd come there to try and rescue. My brain was really trashed by this experience, and it took a while. My words and language came back quite rapidly, literally over hours in a day or two. Childhood memories over several weeks. And then shocking to me, and I tell this story in Proof of Heaven and then elaborate on it much more in the third book, In Living in a Mindful Universe, was the fact that the memories came back so completely after about 2 months that based on very in-depth conversations with close family and friends that I had after the coma compared to similar conversations before coma, I came to realize that my memories were more complete after the coma than they had been before. And this is all material we go into in detail in Living in a Mindful Universe, that memories are not stored in the brain. It's one of the biggest and most profound myths of materialist science, that memories must be stored in the brain. Obviously, if we think consciousness is created by the brain, we must be thinking that memories are stored there. And yet, the evidence for neurosurgeons globally, we've never experienced any kind of cortical resection that led to long-term loss of memory. Now, that's very different from the, we know not to operate on the medial temporal lobes and the hippocampus and those structures because you can interfere with conversion of short-term to long-term memories. And I discuss all that in Living in a Mindful Universe. But in terms of finding long-term memory storage, it doesn't even occur in the brain. And this is kind of the end of that myth of materialist neuroscience that the brain creates consciousness. And this is where the modern neuroscience and the 12 years of experience I've had since my coma, working with scientists around the world, is part of the revolution around the nature of consciousness and its fundamental nature in the universe. And this whole line of reasoning takes into account not only neuroscience and what's called the hard problem of consciousness, but also philosophy of mind is something known as the binding problem, which is just the apparent unity of consciousness within an individual. And then there's all the tremendous evidence for non-local consciousness, things like telepathy, precognition, psychokinesis, the ability to manipulate matter at a distance, distance healing. And then, of course, the big ticket items in non-local consciousness are near-death experiences, shared death experiences, which are just like near-death experiences, but they happen in people who are physiologically normal and healthy. And then also after-death communications and all of that. And then finally, you have that tremendous scientific world that I didn't even know existed, this body of evidence before my coma, but you bet I got into it big time after my coma. And that is all the literature on reincarnation. And for people who want to know more about that, go to uvadops.org, University of Virginia Division of Perceptual Studies. That's a group that's about 15 miles from me. I'm close friends with many of them. I've worked with them. It's a scientific group that has been studying reincarnation stories for 6 decades. They have more than 2,500 cases of past life memories in children where the best explanation is reincarnation. And I can tell you that as a scientist, this is fascinating because this is where the world is headed. The science of consciousness is fully supportive of notions not only of the afterlife, but of reincarnation. And it's just becoming very clear to the scientists who study consciousness and brain and mind that we need a much bigger theater of operations to even begin to explain all of these profound findings. But, you know, the scientists saying that near-death experiences are nonsense and don't occur are over, because the only scientists who say that kind of thing these days are scientists who don't study the voluminous evidence of the nature of consciousness and the primacy of consciousness in the universe. And that's where I think Proof of Heaven has done a wonderful job of opening the eyes of many in the scientific community, as well as the world at large. I mean, Proof of Heaven did extremely well in the U.S., which is a big surprise to me and everybody else, because no near-death experience book had ever done that. But in the year of 2013, when Proof of Heaven came out in the U.S., it was only on sale for 2.5 months, but in those 2.5 months, it worked its way to number 7 on the New York Times bestseller list for nonfiction titles. And the next year, in 2013, it was number 2. On the New York Times bestseller list. And it's now been published in over 40 languages, so obviously it struck a resonant note with humans around this world. And I've heard from a tremendous number of people around the world, and that includes a lot of people who previously bought into scientific materialism, who are very grateful for how this discussion has now enlightened them to the revolution occurring in the scientific world about the nature of consciousness itself.
We are listening to Dr. Eben Alexander on his near-death experience and his books, Map of Heaven and Proof of Heaven. And one of the best ways to get up to speed is go to YouTube and just type in Dr. Eben Alexander, and a whole number of very good interviews will come up, and you can get a real good understanding and really embed yourself deeper in both the universe and God. But better, his website and his blog, ebenalexander.com, ebenalexander.com.
So yes. At that point, you might have some questions.
Well, thank you. Yes, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross came to Auckland back in 1986, and she filled the Auckland Town Hall, and in doing so, with 1,600 people, she really stunned us, and I was actually dragged out of the audience to go and give her the bouquet and thank her at the end of her speech to us, and we were completely astounded with what she had to offer. And the next important thing, Rupert Sheldrake, who has, since mid-1980s, or since his first book, in 1981, he's always talked about that memory is held outside the brain, and he's written...
Absolutely.
Yes, and it's fantastic, because he's one scientist, a Cambridge scientist, who can actually battle it out with all the atheistic, mechanistic, reductionist scientists, and he's very, very adroit at being able to get his story across. And
absolutely. Well, I've met Rupert. I wish I had met Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, but she passed before that. And, of course, those who read Proof of Heaven realized Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was absolutely essential in my putting together, connecting the dots 4 months after my coma about the identity of that beautiful woman on the butterfly wing, because I was reading a book of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross to help me come to that deeper understanding. I don't think I would have gotten there without her kind of enlightening me to that. And, of course, Rupert Sheldrake, I've met him before. He's a delightful and brilliant scientist. And the good news is they're not alone, and I'm not alone. There are hundreds of scientists around the world who are fully on board with this. The other resource I would suggest for your listeners is GalileoCommission.org. Go to that website, and I'm one of the 100-plus scientific advisors to that scientific group who put out that manifesto that was primarily written by Harold Wallach, and it's a beautiful expose of a lot of what we're talking about here, as is the book Living in a Mindful Universe. And also people can certainly go to EbenAlexander.com and learn a lot more about this whole revolution from my blog posting and a lot of the interviews that are listed there. And also, I would just like to mention that so much of the work that I've been doing the last 10 years is about meditation, going within. And you can't even begin to uncover mysteries of consciousness unless you explore consciousness much more deeply. And that's why my co-author of the third book and life partner, Karen Newell, and I, she's the co-founder of Sacred Acoustics, and I would strongly encourage people to visit her website, sacredacoustics.com. You can learn a whole lot more about going within mind and learning using a differential frequency brainwave entrainment for deep conscious exploration. That's exactly what Sacred Acoustics is all about, and that's what this kind of revolution is all about, is exploring consciousness. And meditation is absolutely key to a lot of the health benefits and kind of insights and guidance that we often talk about.
Very much so. Yes, thank you. Yes, I have a friend who did read your first book, and it changed her whole life. It just opened up something profound for her.
Well, I'm so glad to hear that. I hear that same thing from a lot of people and from all different walks of life and all different kind of belief systems. But I think what many people will find encouraging is a tremendous number of scientists, engineers, physicists, physicians, nurses, scientists of all stripes who normally would buy into the falsehoods of scientific materialism, who basically hear this and decide, absolutely, there's a refreshing and far more realistic way to look at ourselves and the nature of reality and the brain-mind connection. And it's very refreshing. I mean, my gosh, who would refuse this knowledge of the reality of eternity of our souls and kind of this infinitely loving future, you know, after we leave the physical body, but then plan to come back to this world, you know, for even greater things beyond. And that it's really about understanding that we're spiritual beings in a spiritual universe.
Yes.
That is a deep scientific fact that if you want to understand consciousness, you cannot ignore. And I think this is great news for all of us, but it also means that we must take responsibility for our choices. And how we treat others is very, very important. And that's why learning the lessons of love and compassion, kindness, acceptance, mercy, and forgiveness are absolutely essential to growing into the higher beings that this whole scientific revolution shows that we are.
Thank you. Yes, you mentioned a vertical path of the learning curve. So the transformation that you went through as a result of this was just stupendous, really. But knowing eternity and really grappling with this profundity of eternity, that we're not locked down into this physicality, and that death is an illusion at many levels. And I think this is so wonderful for people to realize that we go on forever.
Well, it is, you know, it's amazing to realize this. And I'll say that even our understanding of time and space is very much up for grabs, because in so many ways, as modern science, including quantum physics, begins to realize that consciousness is fundamental in the universe and that the physical universe emerges out of consciousness, it gives us a tremendous kind of a vista for what kind of power we actually have in determining our emergent future. So you begin with things like placebo effect as a very powerful example of mind over matter. But what we then start to realize is all of the evolution of this world and the evolution of consciousness and our understanding the destiny of humanity is something that is very much available to kind of analysis and kind of re-understanding as we come to a deeper understanding of these aspects of the universe and of the primacy of mind. So it's a very exciting time to be alive, but I would say that, you know, to date we've called ourselves Homo sapiens. Sapiens means wise. When I look at what we've done to this planet and the warfare and violence and conflict and economic polarization of the addiction to fossil fuels, climate change, plastic pollution, etc., I'm not really seeing a lot of wisdom around. And what I'm thinking is we're about to grow into a far wiser form, but it really necessitates that we let go of this false sense of separation, this business of trying to outdo our fellow beings, you know, competing, and it's a misinterpretation of Darwinian evolution. We really need to see how we're all in this together and how it truly is all about love, and that really will revolutionize this. We've had 5,000 years for various religious systems, you know, to take the messages of prophets and mystics who would venture into these realms, the same realms of an NDE, and come back teaching love and kindness and compassion, and yet our world has not necessarily taken those lessons to heart. Now that it's based heavily in the science of consciousness and the science of reality and a deeper understanding of the mind-brain relationship that will very prominently demonstrate our spiritual nature in a spiritual universe, I think that is where this world will change for the better. People are going to realize this is the way the world works. The more scientists study NDEs and reincarnation stories, the more we realize that our souls have a much bigger purpose, and we really have to live up to that. And that's what this awakening is all about.
Yes, well, the Great Awakening is going to have to happen, and it is happening, because in many ways we seem to be in the birth canal to a new paradigm, and at the moment we're going through a major contraction, so we see what's coming up to meet us. And as you say, that once we accept and realize the greater reality of existence, then we can grow into the light of our own true selves. And I'd like to talk to a little bit of reincarnation. I mean, there's so many cycles in life. There's a potassium cycle, a sulfur cycle, the oxygen or the carbon cycle. There's all the cycles of the greater galactic cycle, etc. We are surrounded by so many cycles. And a lot of them are hidden, but just like reincarnation, this is just...
Absolutely. That's a beautiful way of putting it, because it is another cycle. Although it's very important to point out, this is not the kind of religious tradition such as Buddhism. It's often discussed as kind of get off the wheel of reincarnation to get to nirvana. I think it's important to point out that my view of this, as it's informed by near-death experiences, is really... of the cycling, but it's leading towards a goal. And I think that goal is the evolution of all of consciousness. And I mentioned this briefly minutes ago, but maybe I'll stress it a bit more. It's the book by Pierre Teilhard de Chardin.
Yes.
And it's called The Phenomenon of Man, written in the mid-20th century. He was a French scientist, a paleontologist, but he was also a Jesuit priest. So he had advanced spiritual and scientific thoughts. And he realized that Darwinian evolution, as it was being assembled in the mid-20th century, was just a tiny little version of what was really going on. And what was really going on was the evolution of consciousness itself throughout the universe. And that is what these cycles of reincarnation actually enable, is we come back again and again participating in progressive incarnations in bodily form to energize that kind of expansion of knowledge and knowing of our relationship with the universe, reaching what he called an omega point.
Yes.
That's basically what I saw in my vision, as I said, that kind of Indra's net view of how I saw reincarnation and life reviews deep in the midst of my coma journey, in many ways, was like this vision of Desjardins and his view of the evolution of consciousness itself, because right at the glowing core of that circumferential net, Indra's net that I visualized, was this brilliant energy of the Christ consciousness, of our becoming one with the divine. That was essentially what I was seeing in that fantastic vision, and that's what I believe is unfolding now with the
yes.
scientific awakening,
yes.
awakening to our true nature.
Yes, this is coming forward. It's like every baby born into this realm is an energy bundle of exponential potential and love. And we need to encourage every child or every baby to express themselves, to recognize this.
Absolutely.
Yes.
That is beautiful. That's a beautiful way of putting it. And it's really our responsibility to make this world more like that. If we can envision this, if we see that this is the right thing to do and where it should head, and this vision comes from both our being in this world and also through our meditative and centering prayer experiences that expose us to that world. And then, of course, the spontaneous epiphanies and NDEs and other reports that people give of after-death communications and past life memories and all that. It's really very exciting, and instead of the conventional scientific community has put all this stuff down saying it's impossible because our worldview doesn't explain it, well, that's why we've gotten rid of that worldview. And I mean, even the world of quantum physics, which has been, you know, a deep mystery for the better part of a century, it's absolutely crucial that this deeper understanding of objective idealism or analytical idealism as the philosophical position that best explains the nature of reality is a huge part of this. And that's where quantum physics will emerge with some tremendous lessons, because all the experiments over the last many decades have been pointing towards this. And yet there's been more and more resistance from some in the kind of physicalist camp to invoke consciousness and mind as the ultimate explanation of all this. And yet it's what makes the most sense. And that's where I think all of the scientific community is appreciating this consilience of confirmatory evidence from many lines of work, neuroscience, philosophy of mind, quantum physics, psychology, and parapsychology, that all are showing us the primacy of mind, that mind itself is the primary constituent of the universe. As Sir James Jean said, you know,
yes.
he was a renowned astronomer, physicist, mathematician in England. In the mid-20th century, he said, the universe begins to look much more like a great thought than a great machine. We should herald mind as the creator and governor of these realms. And that's really what we're coming to. And of course, when you realize how important consciousness and mind are, it also opens the door to the power of our free will. because materialist science would scoff at you for claiming to have any free will at all. Conventional materialist science believes that consciousness is an epiphenomenon, an illusion of chemical reactions and electron fluxes in the brain. So they would say there's no place you can inject any kind of free will into those reactions and fluxes that are simply following the laws of physics, chemistry, biology. And yet this complete 180-degree flip of the scientific paradigm about the primacy of consciousness fully enables our will to invoke a world of our dreams. And that is what we need to now start working on and taking responsibility for the love and compassion and kindness that we see are so crucial to this world at large from that larger perspective of the near-death experience and other consciousness-expanded literature.
Yes, thank you. Yes, because we're not here to be born to reproduce to die. We are energy fields in a greater divine universal energy field. And
absolutely.
And when we actually recognize this, that there's 7.8 billion energy fields within the greater planetary field, then a galactic and a universal energy field, we'll really start to realize that we're home all the time, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. Well, you put it beautifully, and I think the other key ingredient in terms of the scientific understanding of those 7.8 billion energy fields is that from the viewpoint of the mental layer of the universe, they're all interconnected.
Yes.
We're all in this together, just like those life reviews show you that you relive the events of your life from the perspective of others around you. So you get to feel like what it felt like to be around you when you did those actions and thoughts. And this is kind of like the golden rule is written into the fabric of the universe. The golden rule, you know, treat others as you would like to be treated, in many ways is the absolute concrete result of life reviews. And this whole kind of concept of the life review and the NDE shows us very clearly how those boundaries of self are part of the fiction that allows for this drama to unfold. But at a deeper level, we're all really in this together. And so to hurt another is truly to hurt myself. And the more we fully grok that and bring that into our choices and living our lives in this universe, the better this planet will be. And it's not just about humans, too. It's really also about the way we treat animals, because animals also have a very rich kind of spiritual existence. In many ways, since they don't have a linguistic center, a little rational voice in their head trying to convince them otherwise, they can have a very rich spiritual essence. But for humans, we have to fight this battle with our little linguistic voice in our head and that kind of rational, logical, materialist scientist viewpoint that keeps saying, wait a minute, the material is all that exists. Well, that's just our little ego and little materialist side of us speaking, but there's a much richer and deeper aspect that's being revealed by the scientific study of consciousness in the current era. And that's one reason I'm so happy to be involved in this work with Proof of Heaven, the Map of Heaven, and Living in a Mindful Universe, all kind of painting a way forward for the world at large.
I agree. Fantastic. Now, there are no accidents in the universe?
From my point of view, no. I believe everything happens for a purpose, and it's important. I came to realize after my coma, very crucial to realize that the apparent darkness, the illness, injury, the hardships in life, in many ways are gifts. They are the energizers that help drive our kind of progress as human beings. And I certainly have come to realize that all the difficulties in my life, and I describe some of my other challenges in the book Proof of Heaven, like, for example, the fact that I stopped drinking alcohol back in 1991. My family and I came to realize that basically it was not good for me. I was behaving like an alcoholic. It was never a problem at work, but I'm glad I gave it up in 1991. But that's just one example. And my meningitis is another beautiful example. These are tremendous hardships and challenges that in many ways energize tremendous growth for me. And I think the more all of us can open up to the possibilities for growth, the more we can start to realize that those challenges, illness and injury in particular, often serve as the vehicles for our growth. They kind of force us to come to a deeper reckoning with ourselves and an understanding of our relationship with the universe. And in many ways, I would say we can show by recovering love for self and others, we can start to show how powerful that force can be in achieving health. And health, for me, is not just physical, mental, emotional health, but deeply kind of psychic and spiritual health, too. They're absolutely essential.
Thank you. In fact,
none of them can exist without the others. That's why this kind of awareness of our spiritual existence and being is so crucial to our individual kind of healing ourselves.
Yes, thank you. Now, no accidents in the universe. Therefore, what happened to you has to be part of a plan to waken up humanity, God's plan, if you will, that what happened to you and how you today are assisting hugely in the awakening of humanity could be seen as a dispensation for humanity, or that, in fact, this was your assignment, this was your mission, Eben, to go through this journey and share your profound story that we are eternal beings. And you're here to allow us or to plug us into our inner candle, to allow us to recognize that we actually do all have an inner candle?
Well, Tim, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I remember people early on when I'd give talks about this, they would say, so this infinitely loving God gave you that case of severe bacterial meningoencephalitis? And I said, no, that was part of what I came here to do. I mean, I already realized by that time, early on after my coma, that this was just, essentially it's part of my growth. Near-death experiences are always tailored to the individual experiencer. But it just so happens that now and then, that experiencer also has a lesson for others. And as a neuroscientist interested in the brain-mind relationship, nature of reality, and the nature of consciousness, some of the lessons I was bound to learn from my NDE also are of value to the world at large. So I would say in many ways, yes, that's true. But I would say all near-death experiences and all, after-death communication, shared death experience, all of these kind of epiphanies that people have about the greater nature, the spiritual nature of ourselves and of the universe are important to share. We're all here to share those stories because that is what will really help this world to grow tremendously. And that's why I'm so glad to be part of the scientific effort like GalileoCommission.org and working with UVADOPS.org, University of Virginia Division of Perceptual Studies. I do a lot of work with them. I work with IONS, the Institute of Noetic Sciences out in California.
Yes, yes.
Dean Radin and that group, They've done a tremendous amount of work. There are scientists all over the world, Peter Fenwick, Penny Sartori in England.
We've gone out of time.
There's a tremendous number of scientists who are interested in this work, and that's what I love contributing to.
Eben, we could go for hours and hours and hours, and I just love what you're sharing with the world. We're here to help humanity. And if you come to New Zealand and manage to break out of the situation in the United States and being able to fly again, we would look forward to seeing you. But we're just completely out of time, so thank you, brother.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate your interest. And I've been to New Zealand once. I absolutely loved it. That was back in 2001, and I would absolutely love to go back there again. So if there's an audience that wants to hear this, I'm more than happy to come down there and talk about it. I'd love to spend some time in New Zealand. And blessings to you and all the work you're doing getting this out there. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much, Eben. I look forward to hearing feedback from all our listeners. I just want to say, kia ora, Eben. Thank you, brother.
All right, Tim. Thank you very much. Great talking with you, and hopefully we'll talk again soon sometime.
Okay. I look forward to that.
All right. You take care.
Same to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. His website and his blog, ebenalexander.com. 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 Decide to network. Use every letter you write, every conversation you have, every meeting you attend, every email you send, and remember, even Facebook, to tweet and to express your fundamental beliefs and dreams. Affirm to others the vision of the world you want. Network through thought. Network through action. Network through love. Network through the spirit. You are the center of a network. You are the center of the world. You are a free, immensely powerful source of life and goodness. Affirm it. Spread it. Radiate it. Think day and night about it, and you will see a miracle happen. The greatness of your own life in a world of big powers, media, and monopolies but of 7.8 billion individuals, networking is the new freedom, the new democracy, and new transparency, and a new form of wholeness and happiness. This originated by Dr. Robert Mueller, Chancellor of the World Peace University in Costa Rica, Central America. I invite you to be able to come to greenplanetfm.com, where we have over 500 interviews in our database, which you can readily download and listen to be able to inspire yourself to become the change you want to see in the world. And become involved in caring for your children and grandchildren's future. We are also on Facebook, on Green Planet FM, and ourplanet.org. Please come and love us. This is Tim Lynch, in the spirit of Aroha, wishing you a wonderful week. We look forward to being with you next week. I say, Kia kaha and haere rā.